May it please the Court. The dispositive issue in this case is whether the benefit Ms. Call received was an accrued benefit within the meaning of Section 12.1 of the plan. Ms. Call received a lump sum payment of a subsidized early retirement benefit calculated using the assumptions set out in the 11th Amendment to the plan. Section 12.1 provides that no amendment will reduce a participant's accrued benefit to less than she would have received had she retired on the day before the amendment. But the benefit Ms. Call elected to receive was not an accrued benefit and thus was not protected by Section 12.1.
Well, the anti-cutback statute defines accrued benefit to include an early retirement benefit. And why wouldn't one assume that the contract in using the accrued benefit language was using the same definition? Is there some reason why there would be a discrepancy between the statutory and the contractual usage?
I disagree with your interpretation of the statute, Your Honor. The anti-cutback rule says two parts. It says, Part A, there shall be no reduction in an accrued benefit. Part B, the following items, early retirement benefits, retirement-type subsidies, optional forms of benefits, shall be treated as accrued benefits for the purposes of this rule. It doesn't say...
It doesn't say for the purposes of this rule. It says shall be treated as reducing accrued benefits. Right. Yeah. So
treated as. There would be no reason to say that.
Think of the logic of it. To say it shall be treated as reducing accrued benefits is to say that these early retirement benefits are accrued benefits. Right?
No, Your Honor.
Treated as reducing. Reducing what? Reducing accrued benefits.
For the purposes of the anti-cutback rule after the 1984 amendments.
Why should be different purposes for your contract? I didn't see in your brief any reason given for your contractual interpretation.
Well, the contract...
simple assumption would be, yeah, accrued benefits, that's a term used in the anti-cutback, and your 11th Amendment is, of course, related, right? You're not cutting back on your benefits. So... the natural assumption would be it's the same definition. So if you have a reason why not? What is your reason?
Well, Your Honor, the language in 12.1 is language that...
I wouldn't do the language. I would say, what is the purpose? Okay, what is the purpose that would be served by interpreting the with the identical term accrued benefits differently in the contract from the statute?
Well, Your Honor, again, I disagree that it's being interpreted differently, but the purpose here is...
Well, obviously it's being interpreted differently, but all right, go ahead, forget. All right.
The purpose here is for plan qualification. The IRS insists that certain language be put in plans when they review plans, and this is language that's very common in many plans. The fact of the matter is, accrued benefits are...
You had to put the words accrued benefits in 12.1? No.
12.1, the IRS requires that plans conform with ERISA in form as well as in operation. You can't just say, okay, paragraph 1, we're going to operate this plan in accordance with ERISA. Here are our provisions. When you put in a plan for qualification, the IRS will say, okay, put this in, put that in, put this in. If you review pension plans, you'll find very similar language in lots of different pension plans.
It said accrued benefits, but we don't mean to include in accrued benefits any lump sums.
I think that in effect is what's done here because...
In effect, it's certainly not in the 12.1, and so that's why I'm asking you, give me a reason, some business reason or something, why it would be sensible to differentiate between the annuities and the lump sums.
ERISA is designed, and pension plans are designed, to protect, give special protection to accrued benefits, normal retirement benefits. There is a purpose in allowing some early retirement benefits, sometimes even subsidized early retirement benefits. There's one provision in ERISA that's quoted by the plaintiffs on one of the regulations that says when you have a subsidized early retirement benefit and you pay that out in lump sum, you can pay that out as the amount of the normal retirement benefit rather than the subsidized early retirement benefit. That's permitted under ERISA. The fact of the matter is there's lots of protections that ERISA gives to accrued benefits that do not apply to early retirement benefits or subsidized early retirement benefits. For example, the vesting requirements do not apply to early retirement benefits or subsidize early retirement benefits.
The cutback rule does.
The anti-cutback rule treats three categories of items as
the same protection to the lump sums as to the annuities.
Right.
Right. And but your 12.1 is a private anti-cutback. So why should you want to cut back the lump sum and not the annuities? Why?
Well, because it would be more expensive.
$31 million.
Well, $31 million is one good reason.
Because you want these people to retire early. You don't have to offer early retirement to people.
Right.
You offer it because you want them to.
That's right.
You want to get
that's
rid
right.
of them, right?
Your Honor, there is a difference, I think you've seen and said, between the statute and the plan. The plan was interpreted by the plan administrator to mean something. The plan administrator's interpretation is entitled to deference under the Firestone rule and under the decisions of this case applying Firestone. The plan defines accrued benefit in a way that's very different from early retirement benefit or lump sum benefits. Now, the plaintiffs argue that, well, that's not applicable here because that's a capitalized defined term in 5.1B and not in 12.1. But surely, if Firestone deference has any meaning whatsoever, the interpretation of this term and the interpretation of whether the capitalization of this term in this section means it's different or the same as the term in other sections is entitled to deference. This case is really a Firestone deference case. The plan language is different from, no matter what the reason for it is, the statutory language. The statutory language does not say.
I don't really see the difference myself. I mean, accrued benefits appears in both. I don't know what.
Right, accrued benefits appears in both. But early retirement benefits, subsidized benefits, and optional forms of benefit appears only in one of them. It appears only in the statute. And the statute makes clear, and the regulations under the statute makes clear, that these are items that are not accrued benefits but are treated as accrued benefits.
That's the difference I don't understand. I don't understand why that is significant.
Well, I think that you'll find that throughout ERISA and things like the vesting requirements, the anti-backloading requirements, the provision as to whether you have to pay it out at the same value as the monthly benefit, those things protect accrued benefits and don't protect things like she received here, which was a subsidized early retirement benefit.
You could have carved out her benefits from your 11th Amendment, but you didn't.
Well, I think we didn't include them. I think the statute added them in, and the plan did not add them in. I also think that the plan language includes another provision that's applicable in this case. 12.1 starts with the provision that no amendment will reduce a participant's accrued benefit. And it goes on to say that no amendment will eliminate an optional form of benefit. At the end, it says, except as otherwise permitted by applicable law or regulation. The plaintiffs interpret the except as otherwise permitted language as applying to the second clause only. We interpret it as applying to the accrued benefit clause as well as the second clause. Because the GATT legislation permitted the change in actuarial assumptions, there's no violation of 12.1. because this is except as otherwise permitted. In response, the plaintiffs argue that the except as otherwise permitted language applies only to the elimination of the optional form of benefits, and they rely on the last antecedent rule. I think it's fair to say that the last antecedent rule is a guide for interpretation, a guide that this court has as often disregarded as it's regarded, and it's not an absolute. So even in the face of this guide, the plan administrator's interpretation of the language is entitled to deference. I would point out, by the way, that the word otherwise in the final clause could certainly be read to refer to section 412C8 in the parenthetical right after the accrued benefit portion of section 12.1. That would support the interpretation that the clause, except as otherwise provided or otherwise permitted, applies to both. If there are no further questions, I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Holtzauer. Mr. Freeman?
May it please the Court, I'd like to address the issues as they were set forth in Mr. Holzhauer's argument. The first issue is whether this benefit was an accrued benefit. He argues they're only treated as accrued benefits. The Supreme Court in the Hines case made clear that early retirement benefits are accrued benefits, and it talked in terms of the 1984 amendments making that clear, talked in terms of the issue being whether a reduction shrunk the value of pension rights and promised benefits, and talks in terms of what the employee has already earned and equates that with already accrued. He's talking about what it's earned. There's no question after Central Labor's Pension Fund versus Hines that early retirement benefits are accrued benefits. And the statute doesn't say the early retirement benefits are treated as accrued benefits. It says the amendment shall be treated as reducing accrued benefits. And that was recognized by this court in Silvernail versus Ameritech, written by Judge Evans, in which it expressly states that Hines interpreted, and I quote, the anti-cutback rule to prohibit a change in terms that would have reduced a benefit already earned, and already earned is italicized in the opinion. So there is, after the amendment of 1984 amendment, there is no distinction between early retirement benefits and accrued benefits in sections A and B.
Doesn't your interpretation give her a windfall? Because, you know, they had a screw up, and as a result, they had this interval in which they were using the longer mortality table with the shorter interest rate to compute your lump sum, whereas you're supposed to have the longer mortality rate and the higher interest rate.
I think there's two or three answers to that. It does not give her a windfall. First of all, you're entitled, as this court has recognized over and over again, once you give someone a benefit, you don't have to give him this kind of generous transitional retirement benefit. But once you give it, it's protected. So they could have drafted it differently. Yes, they didn't have to give her a benefit that operated so the actuarial assumptions made this particular early retirement option more valuable. But second,
were any of these Ameritech employees unionized, covered by any collective bargaining?
No, not this section.
These
people at issue in this case. But it's the opposite of the windfall. What happened here, and this is important for the second issue, the alleged deference of the plan administrator. What happened here is, yes, there was this incongruity in the plan. They used the mortality table for the annuity, and they used the interest rate for the lump sum, and it resulted in a higher amount. But suit was brought on that in Malloy, and Mrs. Call was in this suit in Malloy. She was part of the class. The judge ruled in Malloy, Judge Murphy ruled in Malloy, that all these people who had retired from 1995 to 1999 were entitled to the benefit based on the prior plan because the 95 amendment was not effective. After the argument on summary judgment in Malloy, the Ameritech lawyers saw that the handwriting on the wall, saw the tide was turning against them, so they adopted the 11th Amendment effective July 1, 1999, and excluded Mrs. Call. So Mrs. Call doesn't get the benefits that everybody in the Malloy class got. Plus, if she had retired 3 days earlier, she would have gotten the full, 3 months earlier, excuse me, she would have gotten the full benefits. And Mrs. Call worked for Ameritech for 30 years. And because they wanted to take this sliver of people between July 1, 99 and the date when GATT went into effect, January 1, 2000, they purposely adopted the 11th Amendment to restrict their liability in this case. It was a litigation-driven strategy. It had nothing to do with the plan administrator. There is nothing in the record that supports the idea, the assertion made that the plan administrator interprets 12.1 this way. On the contrary, in June of 1999, when Ameritech adopted the 11th Amendment, the plan administrator sent a letter to these Ameritech managers. I have a copy of it here. If I could hand it to the court, I can submit it. It's referenced on...
Is it in the record?
It's referenced on Supplemental Appendix, page 44. It's Exhibit B to a motion. Yes, it is. And he says to these people, you're protected. He doesn't say 12.1, but he says, we've adopted this, and it's not going to change anything for people who are already in the plan. For people who are not in the plan, it's going to mean something different, but it's not going to change anything for people. So the clients here in the call case who were going through this exhaustion of remedies stopped at that point because they were assured, but they read this letter as assuring them that their benefits would be continued. So the issue here is a reduction in benefits. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about accrued versus early retirement, and I don't think there's that difference anyway in any other part of ERISA. The issue here is, as you say, a private anti-cutback statute and cutback contract. The Section 12.1 is clearly designed to protect someone in precisely these circumstances, where it's a valued employee, they'd like to get rid of her early, they're telling her that if she retires, even though the change may have been permitted by law, the company will protect her. The company will not retroactively take away from her all these benefits she has earned. It's the common sense, as the court has said in Swaback and Dauberton, both recently. You look in this situation, you're not talking about deference in terms of a factual determination or weighing of evidence by the plan administrator, injury or disability. You're talking about a term in a contract, which under ERISA law, you're just as competent to interpret as anybody else, more competent. And you look at, as Swaback says, you look at the ordinary and popular or common sense meaning. And the common sense meaning of Section 12.1 is an accrued benefit means accrued benefit in any form. An accrued benefit is a formula. Once you give someone the right to have a lump sum distribution, once you give him a right to a subsidized early retirement, that is an accrued benefit. If he works under those circumstances and earns that benefit, you can't force him to forfeit it. You can't take it away. You can't reduce it. That's the whole purpose of the anti-cutback rule. And the interpretation they try to put on 12.1 would just make it nonsensical. The first sentence would read, no unlawful amendment will reduce your benefit. Or if you limited it to an age 65 annuity, it wouldn't cover any of these other types of accrued benefits. It wouldn't cover early retirement. It wouldn't cover lump sum. A lump sum is an accrued benefit because it has to be the actuarial equivalent of the age 65 annuity or the normal retirement benefit at the normal age, at the normal retirement age.
The lump sum was calculated using what basis? How was the determination made?
In this instance.
Yes.
Well, the lump sum was first of all was the PBGC interest rate plus the longer mortality table. So she got the benefit of both in terms of the amount. Then in terms of the amount of her early retirement benefit. And I should emphasize, early retirement benefit can be taken either as an annuity or a lump sum. It's not just a lump sum. I mean, she could retire, cash out, and say, beginning on a certain date, as the plan provides, I'll take it as an annuity rather than a cash. But in answer to your question, when they computed it, they went back to the date of her retirement, and they took the early retirement reduction back to when she retired, And they then also did the discounting back to when she retired and calculated her annuity. In terms of damages, the plan claims that because 12.1 says she was entitled to the amount she would have received if she had retired earlier, that you've got to run that early reduction factor back to the date of the amendment of the plan. But Section 12.1 simply defines her rights. Section 12.1 doesn't say anything about how you calculate the benefits. So there's two calculations involved, the amount and then how you discount it back to lump sum. And when she took the lump sum, they did the appropriate discounting.
But she had a choice of either taking the annuity versus a lump sum payout. That was her
she
choice.
Could have taken. She had a series of choices. She had the normal retirement benefit. She had an interim benefit, and she had this transition benefit. And she could have taken this benefit either in the form of an annuity or a lump sum. So I think that Ameritech in their arguments confuses the law with regard to discounting of lump sum with whether or not an early retirement benefit is an accrued benefit. I'd like to say one word though about collateral estoppel, because Ameritech continues to flog the idea that their 95 amendment was valid. First of all, Judge Murphy decided this against them on summary judgment in Malloy. The case law is clear, the leading case, U.S. Bancorp versus Bonner Mall, that even if you settle a case after you lose on summary judgment, it's still collateral estoppel, and Call was in the class at the time. But even more importantly, they raised it because this court has very strictly enforced the rule that if you don't raise an issue before the district judge, it won't be entertained here. So Ameritech couldn't have appealed Judge Murphy's ruling in any event on that ground. So it is bound by the finding that she was entitled to this combination of PBGC rate and the GAM 83, and that in effect, that as a result, the 11th Amendment reduced what she was entitled to if she had retired just before the enactment of the 11th Amendment. And in those circumstances, we contend that it's clear beyond any doubt that Section 12.1 is designed to protect her against that reduction in the benefit that she earned by working at Ameritech for 30 years. Okay. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Holzhauer, how much time does he have? 5 minutes?
Just a few things. I won't take 5 minutes.
Let me just ask you a question following up on what Judge Kaney asked. Is Mr. Freeman correct that she could have taken her early retirement benefits in the form of an annuity?
Yes.
But you would still be arguing, presumably, if she had done that, she still would not have been protected by 12.1, wouldn't you?
If she took her retirement benefits as an annuity at her normal retirement age,
Early retirement.
If she took it as an immediate annuity starting at that time, that would not be an accrued benefit under the plan, under our interpretation. I haven't thought about whether that would affect her calculation, whether that would have...
So in other words, when she took the lump sum... was the actuarial, you can always create an annuity with it that's an actuarial equivalent of a lump sum. So if she had taken her lump sum, instead of a lump sum, she'd taken an annuity form, you're saying that wouldn't be protected either.
Well, I would say that an early retirement benefit, whether it's in a lump sum or it's a monthly benefit, is taken immediately, is not an accrued benefit within the plan. I haven't thought, and I don't think, that the changes made by the 11th Amendment would have affected that for her, but I think under some other circumstances, clearly it could have.
The
actuarial factors used to reduce it to an early retirement might have been the ones in the 11th Amendment.
She worked for 30 years, but she had not yet reached 65 or whatever retirement age was.
She was age 50. She was age 50. A couple of points. Mr. Freeman, I'm sure, just in error, made the argument that the 11th Amendment was a litigation strategy. The fact of the matter is the 11th Amendment was adopted in May of 1999, effective July of 1999. Class wasn't even certified in Malloy until September of 1999, and summary judgment wasn't decided in Malloy until 2000. So the idea that somehow this was a litigation strategy. Instead, it was the amendment that was required by GATT. All plans were in the process during this interim period of scrambling to make their GATT amendments, and they did make that amendment. I don't think the Supreme Court's Hines decision ever says anything more than the benefits in that case were to be treated as a accrued benefit for the purposes of the anti-cutback rule. It said, in fact, that accrued benefits are expressed in the form of an annual benefit commencing at retirement age.
This would be a good case to apply the kind of, I realize not maybe the greatest rule of contract law, but the law that you construe ambiguous provisions against the draftsman. I mean, obviously, the company and its lawyers are very sophisticated and so on. If they use this term accrued benefits, which sounds like, you know, the statutory term, and they fail to carve out the early retirement, why shouldn't you be stuck with the consequences of that poor drafting?
Well, first of all, a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, that's contrary to Firestone. Firestone basically says that if a plan administrator interprets a plan in a way that's not downright unreasonable.
Well, Mr. Freeman said the administrator assured Ms. Call that she was protected.
She was certainly protected in lots of different respects, but not in this this particular respect.
Protect? She thought she had
you know, this, the you purpose know. Of lump sum benefits is to provide a participant with the ability to take out the money immediately so that they can make their own investment choice. The idea is it's supposed to be cost neutral to the plan, not deplete the plan assets. We can go through the whole history of that and how the interest rate balloon in the 70s and late 70s, early 80s affected this. One thing I wanted to make sure to point out is the 1984 Act that adopted the treated as language, and the language of the statute says, for purposes of paragraph 1, a plan amendment which has the effect of eliminating or reducing an early retirement benefit or a retirement-type subsidy. For purposes of paragraph 1 is the anti-cutback rule.
Oh, sure. We know that the anti-cutback rule doesn't apply here. That's not the question. The question is, if a plan adopts by way of contract its own little anti-cutback rule,
right,
and uses the term accrued benefits, is it legitimate to go to the statute and say, well, here's where cutback is defined? It doesn't govern you, doesn't bind you, but if you use that language without modification, accrued benefits, people will think, yeah, that's I get the same protection I'd get from the anti-cutback rule.
Your Honor, my time is up, but can I answer that?
Yeah, of course.
The fact of the matter is the plan does not adopt everything in the statute. The statute has two parts. It has the accrued benefit part and has the treated as part, which applies to early retirement benefits. Early retirement benefits are different from accrued benefits in lots of sections of ERISA. The plan language doesn't include that part.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.